Well, hello, 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 and welcome back to Gateway to Anime. How are you all? What's going on? We are the podcast where we try and throw open the gates to anime, whether you're a new fan, a returning fan, or an anime veteran. Just a bit of housekeeping before we start. If you really like what we're doing or want to know what we're up to, go to our website, gatewaytoanime.com. You can also find us on TikTok, Instagram, and or YouTube. And if you really like what we're doing, you can find us on Patreon. Charlie, how are you firstly?
I'm good, excited to be here and incredibly excited because today we have a very special guest and I'm so keen to get into this particular topic and chat about everything. So Sam, do you want to introduce our very special guest for today?
Absolutely. So today we are very fortunate to be joined by Alex Henderson, who is the technical editor of the Anime Feminist blog website. Alex has completed a doctoral thesis about queer representation in fiction just last year, 2023, and runs the blog The Aficionado. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. And please, can you tell us about you, the anime feminist, all of the above? Please introduce yourself to the Gateway people. Thank you.
Well, hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me, first of all. It is awesome to be here. My name is Alex. I'm one of the managing editors at Anime Feminist. I also do a bit of freelance editing here and there about the place, including for another website called The Anime Herald. Independently of that, I have been blogging and reviewing anime for, I want to say, about 11 or 12 years wow. now, which seems like a zany number, but it is true. And as you said, yes, in my other life, my non-anime world, I did a doctoral thesis that I finished just last year, which was specifically looking at queer representation in young adult fiction. So I like to talk about stories, which is good news because I think that's what you want me to do tonight.
Absolutely, absolutely. So once again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate someone with your knowledge.
I'm extremely excited about this because I have been a longtime lurker of Anime Feminist as a website. It's one of those things where, and we will talk about this as the whole topic goes along, but kind of navigating being a fan of anime when sometimes anime doesn't reflect your own personal belief values and sometimes there's representations that you don't necessarily agree with, but trying to kind of be able to find stories that do, because there's just so many stories because anime is just, you know, a huge genre. It doesn't like mean one thing. I found that the Anime Feminist was just an amazing resource for me to find that, just to be able to kind of go onto a website, see what people have, like obviously very intelligent, very well-read people who've done a lot of research on this and have kind of given recommendations. They do reviews, they do like breakdowns of seasonal anime, and there's a podcast, there's so much there. And it's been a wonderful resource for me, particularly when I was getting back into anime and trying to navigate all that. So I thank you very much for coming on the show because I have used your publication many, many times and I'm just so stoked to have someone here from Anime Feminist. I am a fangirl.
That is awesome to hear that we have been so helpful for you along the way. Yeah, like you've said, the idea behind the site was kind of to help people navigate a couple of fandom problems that you folks have talked about on this very podcast, which is that, first of all, yeah, not all of them, obviously, but some anime fandom spaces can be a bit exclusive, maybe a bit unfriendly to women and or other marginalized people. And also, secondly, sometimes finding new anime or recommending anime can be a bit of a minefield in terms of things like, oh, this rom-com is really sweet. And, oh, okay, it's full of gratuitous fan service of 15-year-old schoolgirls. Okay. Or, oh, this action series is really fun. It's really cool. Oh, but the character writing just really like relies on cliches about men and women having to be certain ways. Those are experiences that we will all have. So the idea behind the site was to kind of create a space and a platform for people to talk through those complications of this art form that we all love, but maybe doesn't always love us back. And of course, the idea with that is not that we're like making a golden list of like, these are the feminist anime that are good and everything else is misogynistic and bad, because it is much more complicated than that, of course. You know, like even within one series, you can have some elements that are really interesting and progressive and some other elements right next to them that are not so much. And of course, individual audience members will differ as well. Different people will have different levels of tolerance or different resonances with different stuff that goes on. So like you said, Charlie, we really try to make a space where we put out reviews, we put out feature articles from contributors from all over the world, and we try to cast a pretty wide and inclusive net of like what feminism is and like what feminist criticism is. Like, it's not just women's issues, but, you know, it's queer representation, it's the discussions of gender and sexuality in anime, it's discussions of ethnicity and race in anime and disability and, you know, political underlyings. Because, of course, a certain subset of fan may tell you there's no politics in anime. but sometimes there is.
Yeah. I just could never understand that point.
Oh, Lord.
I just like literally can't even think of an anime that's not. Anyway, there you go.
We'll let that one go. Good. But yeah, I mean, so today we want to talk about some anime which we have talked about on the show before, but one which we have not, which we're really excited to hear your thoughts on, Alex. But we sort of wanted to talk about anime which does tackle queer representation in, you know, across the spectrum pretty well, we feel, these three shows. But of course, talking about these three shows specifically, we will of course stumble across many others, and we're very much looking forward to hearing some recommendations from you about shows that, you know, potentially we haven't seen at all or aren't aware of. First of all, before we dive into that part, how did you come to work at Anime Feminist? How did you get involved with all, and even just writing about fiction in general?
Well, I mean, I started writing about fiction because you kind of couldn't stop me from doing so. I'm just always been one of those people who's like, no, I'm thinking about this. I need to put it into words somehow. And so, you know, I started the blog just like coming out of high school, basically. And it's, so it's, you know, a terrible, beautiful time capsule of, you know, the things I was obsessed with and really thinking about, you know, over the past decade or so. But in terms of AniFem, so I started as a contributor, actually, when the site was first sort of getting off its feet. I heard somewhere, I think through reading someone else's blog, there's this new website that's trying to get up, you know, they're doing sort of intersectional feminist critique of anime and manga and light novels and all that jazz. And I thought, I'll do that. Can I get paid to do that? Is that a thing that's allowed? And so I put in a pitch and one of them was accepted. And that was, gosh, this was back in 2017. So my first article for them was about the kind of trend that was emerging at the time of like the dark magical girl genre. So kind of like everybody who watched Madoka Magica and was like, oh, cool, they're suffering and it's edgy, with and missed kind of the point of, you know, the kind of like more positive, hopeful ending of that show. And, you know, so it had a lot of sort of copycats. And I was sort of talking about like, what does that mean for the genre that was like traditionally for, you know, kind of complicated but ultimately empowering for small girls. What does it mean now that it's been kind of co-opted by these grungy, gritty, you know, stories aimed at adult men? And that, you know, went through a lot of editing because I was just a little baby writer coming out of my undergrad degree, but it got published. It apparently started a lot of discourse, a lot of discussion, none of which I saw any of because I was too scared to check the comments. I took the money and ran with that one. but yeah, and, you know, that was a pretty positive experience, you know, working with our editorial team and helping develop the ideas. And so I sent another pitch a few months later and kind of got into a semi-regular thing. And so in 2020, sort of around that time, the site was starting to really pick up traction and expand to the point where they wanted to bring on some more editors. And so I was one of the people that they reached out to see if I wanted to come on board, to, you know, come on the other side of the coin and see how the proverbial sausage gets made. And I've been there ever since. And yeah, I've sort of fighting my way up in the ranks to now I'm, yeah, one of the sort of technical editor, and I help a lot with sort of content organization and things. And yeah, I find myself on podcasts all the time. It's not something I would have necessarily expected a few years ago, but so yeah, it's a very like, you know, inclusive, tight-knit kind of community. And yeah, it's been really, we're a small team, but we're really cool people. And it's just like been lovely to be a part of it, and or, you know, continue to be a part of it for hopefully many, many years to come.
Well, it's doing so many interesting things. And you know, I mean, academic study of anime is fascinating in and of itself, but also in such a positive and progressive manner. It's such a great, wonderful site. Absolutely brilliant resource for everyone out there who hasn't checked it out. Please check it out. If nothing else comes from this episode, please go and check out Anime Feminist. I guess we should start talking about some shows. Who wants to kick it off? Do you want to start, Charlie? Alex, would you like to start?
I want to hear from Alex because Alex is talking about a show that I watched when it was airing a few years ago, which I loved and then promptly forgot about until you and I went, that's right, this show is incredible. And I think I'm really looking forward to hearing your take on it because I think that I watched it very base level. And I think looking back now, I'm like, there's so much more to that show that I would love to hear about and kind of see from another angle.
All right. So I would like to bring as my book report today, Land of the Lustrous, which is on High Dive, if you're in Australia. Yeah, as you say, Charlie, is kind of a, forgive the pun, a bit of a forgotten gem, maybe. Maybe a bit of, you know, flew a little bit under the radar. And I like this as an example because if there's one thing I kind of want to get across with these recommendations today, it's that, like, a queer story doesn't have to be just one thing. It can be all sorts of stuff. It's not, like, a genre by any means. Yes. I think maybe some people can kind of have in their mind that, like, oh, it has to be a coming out story, or it has to be a romance between two people of the same gender, or it has to be about, oh, you're being bullied and you hate your body and you're like, your life sucks. Or I guess a stereotype at the other end of the spectrum is, like, it's all hot yaois with beautiful anime men being smushed together for the enjoyment of female fans and doesn't actually, like, reflect any lived experience of gay men. All of those things certainly exist, but there's a very broad umbrella of queer storytelling, you know, all over the world. And today we're talking about Japanese media. So Land of the Lustrous is fun also because it's not necessarily, like, immediately obviously a queer series. I'll just tell you what it's about and we can kind of get there along the way. So this is set on Earth, but not as we know it. This is a very distant, far-flung future where humans are no more, but we have sort of various groups of human-shaped beings that are coexisting uneasily. Our main group are the Lustrous, who are a group of people made of gems and minerals. They're all named after what they're made of. So we have diamond, amethyst, jade, etc. And we have the Lunarians, who are a group of spooky moon people who come down with bows and arrows and try to hunt the Lustrous to turn them into jewelry because they're made of gemstones. And, you know, very, very, a bit existential body horror with that, but that's just the beginning. Our main character of this series is the baby of the family and the weakest of the gems, whose name is, I want to get this right, Phosphophyllite, or just Phos for short. And they are really annoyed with their position in society. They really want to do more, but they're, like, not strong enough to fight. Like, if you hit them at the wrong angle, they will just shatter into a million pieces. And they can be put back together, but it's certainly not convenient. And so Phos has this frustration, and kind of to shut Phos up, the higher-ups in the gem community give them the task of being a natural historian and going around the island that they all live on and making an encyclopedia. And that sends Phos off inadvertently onto a journey that will change their life forever. So funky post-human sci-fi, not necessarily the setting you think of when you maybe think of, like, an LGBT story, but this is really interesting because it is a great example, I think, of how, like, sci-fi and fantasy, like, allegory can be used to get into, you know, really realistic things that are affecting a lot of real people, but you're kind of talking about it sideways. You're kind of, like, not in metaphor is the wrong word, but basically, this is a story that is about a character who is frustrated that the body they have has assigned them a certain role in society, and so they start seeing what they can do to change that. And there are lots of questions along the way about the connection between the physical body and identity, and the connection between that and your social role. And I've been saying they, you'll notice as well, for Phos and the gems, because it's obviously a little bit different in the Japanese original track, but in the English localization of the manga and the subtitles that are on High Dive, they've opted to use neutral pronouns for all of the gems, which is pretty cool. Mm. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because they don't have gender. Like, they don't have men and women. They have, you know, ruby and sapphire and phosphophyllite, like, and you have this sort of this system, obviously, where, yeah, your social position and the things that you can do and the things that are expected of you is determined by what you're made of. And someone wanting to sort of rebel against that and get outside of that is treated as a bit weird. So it's a very gender story, even though the characters in it would not use terms like non-binary or transgender to describe themselves. That is a really, like, powerful way to read it, and it makes a lot of sense if you are looking at it through that lens.
Interesting. Absolutely. And it's interesting because you were saying that, I was like, that, of course, they were completely gender neutral pronouns that entire run now because I watched the localized version, obviously. The show itself, I mean, when it came out, most of the conversation around it was about how it was like one of the first shows to make CG look good. That was like the main conversation that people were having. I think it was Studio Orange that did it. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, they ended up doing Stampede as well, Trigun.
But the CGI.
People, and the animation is incredible. But now I really need to go back because that just is an absolutely fascinating read. And that is clearly what the show is actually about when you kind of look back at it.
Yeah, the visual style is really striking, which is fascinating too, because like the visual style in the manga is also really striking, but in a completely different way. Mm. Like they did not try at all to like adapt it directly. They went for their own funky new thing. But yeah, it's a super interesting one. And I mean, you can still get a lot out of it without that kind of like genderqueer read of it, but and you know, like people have talked as well about how like it speaks to perhaps a narrative about disability. There's also all of these sort of thematic threads through there about sort of Buddhism and reincarnation, which admittedly went a little bit over my head when I first watched it. So, you know, multiple perspectives really bring something new each time you go back. It's a super interesting series. And the funny thing as well is when it first came out, I found it fascinating. And I was like, this whole thing with like the gender and the body and the, oh, that's so interesting. Oh, but I have no business writing about that because I'm, you know, I'm cisgender. Cut to me realizing I'm non-binary like 2 years later, being like, oh, hang on. That's why I found it interesting. Yeah. So, look, you never know. Yeah.
Well, Sam, what show did you watch that you'd like to recommend?
Well, we talked about this back in, I'm talking like maybe our third ever episode. So it's definitely worth a revisit. But we did it when we had Brett on the show, who's in the early days of this show, it was about me walking my friend who was essentially the audience avatar through the world of anime with Charlie, and we were like guiding him through.
I was just a guest.
In the early days, yeah, absolutely.
Really,
yeah.
Climbed the ladder here, so it's good. Like, Brett's not here anymore, so.
Well,
like,
you know,
he's great. We love
him. We do love Brett, but that shtick ran its course, and now, of course, we've changed a little bit. But that was the last time Brett actually spoke about this show, because it was one of the shows we tasked him with in, I believe it was Shoujo.
Yes, because obviously we are gateway to anime, so we tend to, and particularly we like to do focus on shows that could be very well received if you are new to anime. And I do believe that the one that you're going to talk about is one that a lot of people could like who might not necessarily have a big background in anime fandom or anything.
Oh,
like, could come into it just completely fresh. So that was one that we used early on. So we obviously backed it that hard as a gateway anime.
We did.
That was
one
of the first ones we did. So
that's it. And we're back. So we're talking about Yuri on Ice. So for those of you who don't know, after a humiliating loss at the Grand Prix finale, Yuri Katsuki, once Japan's most promising figure skater, has to return to his family home to reassess his future. Given ice skating is a young person's game at 23, and he got into it a bit older, his time's fast running out. And add to the fact he really likes pork cutlets, and almost more than anything else, and his ability to maintain his fitness and physique isn't fantastic. He's not like naturally, he's naturally gifted in some ways, but not compared to who becomes his mentor. But after a video of Yuri performing a routine previously executed by the legendary 5-time world champion Viktor Nikiforov, hope I got that right, suddenly goes viral, Yuri finds himself back in the public eye. And when Viktor himself turns up at Yuri's family home, offers to be his mentor. Yuri, of course, idolized Viktor growing up. He accepts instantly. And basically, Viktor starts to train him to get back to the top for the new season. But his namesake, a rising star from Russia, Yuri Pilsetsky, is determined to reach the top first and win back the mentorship of Viktor, whom he has lost to Japanese Yuri. Now, this was produced by MAPPA. It was one of MAPPA's really early ones, created by two women, Sayo Yamamoto and Mitsuru Kubo. They haven't actually done that much since, which is quite interesting. I was looking through their My Anime list to be like, oh, I would have thought it would have gone on to do way more interesting things. But Sayo Yamamoto actually started out at Madhouse and worked under Satoshi Kon and Shinichiro Watanabe, which I wasn't aware of. She worked on Space Dandy. Yeah, her first anime was actually called Michiko Tohachin, which was now made by the defunct studio Manglobe. And like Yuri on Ice was an anime original, so Yuri on Ice completely made by this dude, wasn't a manga, no source material. And that was a story set around a single mother and a prison convict, Michiko Melandro and her daughter Hachin and their adventures across various cities, mostly based on South America, but also influences from Southeast Asia and the Caribbean. But what's quite interesting about that show is that it was focused on non-Japanese characters, quite rare for anime, unless it's like in a fantasy world, and actually was inspired by Sayo's trip to Brazil. And the main character actually, which is I thought was interesting, constantly changes outfits. So normally, of course, you know, Naruto wore that one orange bit of gear for 30 years until he got became Hokage.
I respect that, to be honest.
You know, if you got a look, go for it, right?
Hey,
you know?
It's not wasteful. It's good.
It's not. It is sustainable.
Absolutely. So that sustainable is good. Fashion.
That is
Naruto.
Sustainable fashion.
100%.
Yeah, Yuri on Ice, I just thought it was so fantastic. I mean, it's so interesting because I believe in the early days it was actually criticized for queer baiting in the by a lot of the fandom until obviously by the end it was like, oh, wait a minute, no. But it's interesting that the way that Yuri and Victor's relationship kind of develops, it's so real and it's stylized. Like, Victor's an interesting character because he reminds me a lot of Gojo. You know, that's kind of who I, in aesthetic, but also the kind of, he's so on a different level. I mean, at least in the early days, he's so on a different level. He's so like, I suppose if you want to use like a power system, he's like so powerful because he's like the literal
king. An OP ice skater.
Yeah, he's way overpowered ice skater.
100%. Like,
yeah, and of course there's a huge power dynamic, which I found at first a little bit like kind of off-putting. I mean, they're both in their 20s. Like, Yuri's 23 and I think Victor's 28. So like there's no problematic issue there. But there is a big power imbalance, which gets played on a fair bit. But I quite liked, not only did I like the relationship that developed between them, but I also just thought, while we pitched it to people who had never maybe seen anime before, it's just something you can just watch irrespective, because also the mapper at Full Flight, it looks amazing.
So interesting about Yuri on Ice is very much a sportist anime.
Very much a
sportist
anime.
That's the thing. And so you kind of get carried away with, it's been so many years since I watched it, but it's one of the animes that got me back into anime.
I remember when
I had a weird break from anime. I don't know why. I just went, I'm done. And then Yuri on Ice and Assassination Classroom got me back in. So that's
underrated.
Both great shows. But Yuri on Ice, I think in terms of their relationship and everything and the way that it pans out and the love of the sport and the dedication to the craft and how it's treated, I like the idea that ice skating, which I believe is the most difficult sport to do ever.
It's ridiculous.
Like how is treated with just such a level of respect. And I like. And also is something that would be, you know, in terms of if I think of sports anime, I kind of conjure up like a shonen kind of like,
IQ.
You know, yeah. And I think ice skating is something that is not typically kind of in that like masculine space.
That's a good point.
And I think that the way that Yuri on Ice handles it, it makes it just like incredibly powerful, great. I don't know. I think it's a really good show and I think it handles ice skating as a sport really well and gives it a high amount of respect.
What I loved about part of it was both the Yuris have to get in touch with their feminine side a lot to get better at the sport. Like, Yuri goes and gets trained by a prima ballerina, even though he's a much more sort of masculine presenting, the Russian Yuri, and then goes and like finds much more femininity to bring into his performance, which opens his performance up to so many different things. And ditto Yuri when he's doing the Eros tech routine, and he's imagining it kind of initially like it's a dance sort of between a philandering cad into a town who whisks the most beautiful woman off her feet, and then he's like really struggling to connect with that, and then all of a sudden it opens up for him and he's like, no, I'm the woman in this story, that's I'm being swept, I'm sort of performing for him. And I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
Yuri on Ice is fantastic. Is it old enough that I can call it a classic?
Yeah.
I think it is.
And interesting too that you mention the fandom concerns about queer baiting back in the day, because again, it's an original anime, so you didn't have like a source material, so everyone was kind of like on tenterhooks being like, wait, are they going to actually end up together? Which I mean, especially, I don't watch a lot of sport anime, but from what I understand, it's one of those genres where there's a lot of like hot-blooded male rivalries that like people get very inspired to like, you know, ship them together.
Yeah.
So the notion that like, oh, this is a sports anime, but there's actually a genuine, sincere romance between these two men was a bit different. And people were kind of like, is this like happening for realsies? Which, I mean, is even a thing that happens today. Like, did you guys watch Mobile Suit Gundam, The Witch from Mercury, when that came out last
year? Graham did.
I watched the first half of the first season, and I loved it. But it was giving me Utena vibes hard. So I don't,
yes. Especially that first bit. I'm like, is this Utena in space? Because that was a fascinating thing as well, because that was also an original property, while also obviously being a spin-off of the pre-existing Gundam franchise. And yeah, like first episode, it's like, okay, these girls are politically engaged. One of them has made a comment about how it's not weird for women to be married to each other, and what kind of backwater planet are you from that you think that's a big deal? And it's making all these Utena references, which, as we may talk about later, very iconic queer anime. So everyone was kind of like looking around in all directions, being like, are they doing this for real? Are these girls going to fall in love in this like mainstream giant robot sci-fi? And nobody knew. And so there was an interesting back and forth, but people being like, if they don't end up together and this turns out to be bait, I'm going to be heartbroken and so annoyed. And, you know, minus spoilers, it didn't. Although there was, linking nicely back into Yuri on Ice, actually, this is also an interesting part of, like, the conversation around what is not censorship per se, but, like, obviously industry concerns about, like, what is suitable to show. So, okay, so this is a frustrating but also kind of funny story. Again, no spoilers, but the Gundam show ends. There is a romantic subplot between two girls. It goes well for them, as romantic subplots often do. And there was an interview with, I think, the two main voice actors where they referred to this relationship as a romantic relationship, as them being girlfriends, them being perhaps even wives. And I believe that was on a podcast or a stream. And then when the print version of that interview was shown in the Gundam magazine, that reference to the romance had been taken out. Now, Gundam nerds are watching both, obviously, because they're more powerful than God. people noticed and were like, hey, why did you take that out? And the kind of executive response on it was, oh, we didn't want to pin that down. We wanted to leave that relationship open to interpretation. So first of all, open for interpretation became a meme for a couple of weeks. Because again, no spoilers, but the ending is very much, that really felt like a romantic arc and a happy ending, you know? But, you know, it was really interesting because it shows that, like, obviously we are getting a bit more queer representation coming into anime in sort of dribs and drabs. But there's obviously this tension between the artists who really want to make this happen and sort of executives or companies or other people in the studio system who are, for whatever reason, maybe a bit more cagey about making that a thing, whether they don't want to worry about offending people or like losing money, because that's often what it comes down to. And so, you know, that happened last year, it echoed in a lot of ways, like some of the conversation around Yuri on Ice and how, like, Sayo Yamamoto, for example, I know had gone on record being like, yeah, I really had to fight to get what we got. Some people even thought that Yuri and Victor's relationship was still too ambiguous. I'm like, they exchanged rings. What are you talking about? Those men are getting married. You know, but like stuff like they do a kiss, but it has to be kind of hidden by his arm so you don't see the lips locking. Which, my God, I remember the discourse about that back in the day. People were like drawing diagrams, being like, no, they can't have kissed on the mouth because of this. And people saying, no, they have to have kissed on the mouth because of something. Just like absolute madness. But, you know, like that sort of fandom reaction side of things, especially like in English language fandom spaces where we've often been raised on Hollywood movies. So we're kind of looking for different signifiers of like what a romance looks like, which anime may not necessarily give us for whatever reason. So yeah, questions about like, is it queer for realsies? Is it bait? Is it just subtext? What's going on there? Like that is very kind of a complex space that's only getting more complicated.
Oh, absolutely.
So it reminded me of when, this is not anime, but obviously when Korra, the last seven, the ending of that had a female romance and people were kind of like, but there was a heterosexual romance in there earlier. And it was like, oh, you know, bisexuals do exist actually. You know, that is a thing. There is more, yeah, there's more to this. So I remember that was interesting and quite obvious and they kind of backed that, which was good. So yeah, I haven't finished the Gundam Mercury, but I just assumed that was going to get romantic. So I'm glad to hear it does. But, so I will probably finish that.
Yeah. And it's an example too of like genre fiction that kind of like happens to also include a queer romance, which again, is not necessarily what you think of. Like you may, going back to your kind of bare bones stereotypes, like, oh, it's all about the characters being queer. It's like, no, like, listen, they're falling in love and it's all complicated, but they also have to like deal with evil mega corporations and war machines in space and have robot fights because it's a robot fighting show. And that's really cool, you know, like that's a really interesting like new frontier of representation.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned before how it's sort of we're seeing it even more in slightly more mainstream shows, but again, not perhaps overtly, but I mean, even Attack on Titan, there was between Ymir and Historia. Now, that wasn't, I think you could argue that's not overt at all, but it's certainly something, there was a lot, of maybe it's been read into, but it's still something that was actually happening there that looked like two female characters in love, to, you know, whether or not it was overt or not.
Yeah, but then they just ruined Historia's character in the end. So.
Oh, and Ymir's.
Absolutely.
Why did Ymir go with them? It made no sense.
But at that moment, that was great. Yeah.
We're not opening this can of worms. We've gone off track.
There was a second Attack on Titan talk. Good. And I was like, oh no, we're out. Yeah.
But no, it is very interesting. But Charlie, why don't you talk about what we talked about in our previous time we talked on the subject, which was the feminism episode, and we've mentioned it, it's popped up a few times already because it is such a seminal cornerstone of the genre in anime.
Indeed. So I talked about this this series when we did an episode on anime and feminism, and it was about 3 or 4 years ago now, I think.
2021, yeah. Oh
yeah, and yeah. I kind of live in fear about what I said then. You know, you kind of like, typically when you're looking at ideas of feminism, academic readings, things like that, intersectionality and your opinions changing on things, and it kind of should be ever evolving. I think that's an important thing with podcasts. Yeah, it kind of exists as a bit of a time capsule of things. But I think that this show is just one that is, you can't really talk about queer representation in anime without bringing up this show in particular. And it's funny because I was stating that we're a gateway to anime and that there should be, you know, like we should do shows that are really great for people just starting out on anime. This is one that I would absolutely not recommend starting out on. I think you need to be an anime fan to really get behind Revolutionary Girl Utena. And I have got some notes. I'll just tell everyone who hasn't heard about this show before. It is a like an original, so again, another anime original that was created by B-Puppers. It's a production group formed by the director, Kunihiko Ikuhara, who was the series director on Sailor Moon, who actually left Sailor Moon because they were frustrated with the lack of creative control they had over adapting a manga series. So they went, we're going to do this. And what I find interesting about this is that they kind of went into the adaptation or making this show with the idea of capitalizing off the success of Sailor Moon and having Magical Girl show and making it kind of friendly to that. And what they kind of ended up with was the most like subversive, surreal, like pretty intense show. And I'm like, I just love the journey that they obviously had from pre-production to production to post was, I was like, a lot went on there. And now it's one of the most iconic shows. So I will just read a quick synopsis for people who don't know. Years ago, a tragic incident befell a young princess when both her parents died. Devastated, it seemed nothing would calm this poor soul. However, a prince traveling through the area came to see her princess, hoping to cheer her up. After wiping her sorrowful tears, the prince gave her a ring carrying a rose emblem and told her as long as she holds onto the ring, they are destined to meet again. The event leaves a deep impression on the girl, Utena, leading her to become a prince herself. Years later, Utena attends Utori Academy, recognized by the same rose emblem as her precious rings. There, attracted by the scent of roses, she witnesses Anthe Himemiya tending to the flowers, accompanied by the student council president and the vice president, who seem to be arguing over Anthe. While Utena thinks nothing of the occurrence, the student council gathers to discuss an important matter. Subsequently, a misunderstanding leads to Utena being dragged into the world of duelists, those with rings similar to her own. The duelists fight for the ownership of the Rose Bride, Anthe Himemiya, who is said to possess a great power. Wanting to prove her capabilities as a prince and enraged that Anthe is being wronged and objectified, Utena resolves to fight against the duelists to save her from the cruel fate. So this is a very complicated story, but not really. One thing about Utena is that I could say the storyline, but it has to be seen because this story is told so much in visual storytelling. It's 90s anime, very classic shoujo styling, but everything that is kind of on the screen, it's somewhat low budget. So anything that is there is so deliberately there, and you could analyze this show until your eyes are bleeding. Like, honestly, it is just so much there. And it's a, you know, thesis wet dream at this point. Like, it is so good for that reason. But obviously, in terms of how this is a queer anime. We have a lot of factors at play here. Obviously, there is a very clear dichotomy between the role of a prince and a princess and the idea of gender roles and non-conforming to gender roles and the toxicity between the gender binary. I think that is a huge aspect of this show. But we also have a very, in my opinion, explicitly romantic relationship between two female leads of Anthy and Utena. Now, apparently when this was airing, people were arguing that they were not romantic. Apparently that was a thing that people still were kind of like, no, I don't think it's romantic between them. And I'm just like, I don't know, that seems wild to me, particularly by the end of this series. I don't want to spoil anything for this show, but all I will say is that the trigger warnings and content warnings on this piece are so extensive that there is a literal blog dedicated to someone outlining how many like content warnings there are. So please be careful if you're wanting to watch this one. There is a lot of darkness in it. And one thing that usually I wouldn't promote a show that actively kind of talks about these kind of subjects, which is very much coming of age, loss of innocence, the idea of a power dynamic, sexuality, discovering yourself, sex as power is like a huge thing in this show because Utena is 14 years old. So it is deeply uncomfortable. But I think you have to put it into context of when this show was airing. And I think that there are several other shows that were the magical girl genre, a lot of Clamp shows. So you're kind of looking at Cardcaptor Sakura, which I love and I don't want to, you know, shit all over because I absolutely love that show. But there was a lot of ideas of kind of romanticizing, particularly like adult relationships with children, essentially. And Utena, I think, shows that in quite a explicit and horrific way. It's not glorifying it at all. It's actually going, this is the darkness that comes along with these tropes that we are aware of in storytelling, which makes me go, I feel okay about watching this because it is clearly a subversion. It is clearly something that is subverting fairy tales even. There's a lot of imagery that is like classic prince, princess, you know. Anyway, I'm rambling right now, but I really love this show. And
oh, Utena does that to a person. It does, right?
Its visual and narrative style is characterized by a sense of theatrical presentation and staging, drawing inspiration from the all-female Japanese theater troupe, the Takarazuka Revue, as well as experimental theater of Shuji Terayama, whose frequent collaborator, whose name is J.A. Scissor, created the songs featured in the series. And, you know, you could argue that there's like a simple juxtaposition of prince and princess archetypes, but I think that it's kind of using it like to examine how gender roles in general are just restrictive and toxic. So the role of a princess and the role of a prince all equal the same terrible system. And all of the evils that are kind of happening in Utena are very much from, I would say, that lens.
I mean, well, like, speaking about anime feminists, you will notice on the site, and in fact on my shirt, if you're watching the I don't know how well you can see it, if watching the video version, we have a sword and a rose in our logo, and that's not an accident.
Hey.
This is like, I'm wearing sword-shaped earrings as well for the
stunning
visual version for this very reason. Yeah, this one, it kind of like cracks your brain open like an egg when you first watch it, because, and it's, I agree with you, it is a difficult one to recommend because it does have that, you know, it deals with so many heavy themes and unpacks them. It's also just very strange on purpose, which I can definitely see being a barrier of entry to some people. And yeah, it's in conversation with like old school shoujo and fairy tales and the concept of gender roles and heteronormativity. Like, it's just doing everything. Again, no spoilers because this is a show that obviously content warnings notwithstanding, it's kind of very rewarding to let it unfold as it goes along, because it does a lot of repetition, partially because they were saving money by reusing like stock footage of like transformations and like, you know, things like that. But also I think to lull you into this weird like dreamlike state before it like snaps you out of it and reveals like something impactful and horrifying about a character, or like it takes you out of the dream and shows you the reality that you was being hidden by this illusion. And like the further you go along, especially, is very impactful in terms of that. And I think it, honest to goodness, has one of the most rewarding, like, oh, this character is not who you thought she was as a person kind of character arcs. And rewatching it, like knowing what you later learn about that character is like such a different experience. So, you know, if you're going to watch Utena, watch it twice. which again, makes it a bit of a hard sell because that's a fairly hefty amount of episodes.
And also another hard sell is you can't skip the recap episodes because they're not actually recap episodes. They a lot of stuff happens in the recap episode. So you got to watch those. And there's like three of those. So another hard sell. You can't even skip that.
And you can't skip like the goofy filler episodes either, because they're often about Nanami and she's hilarious. Like she's awful, but she's so good. And you cannot skip Nanami.
Yeah, you can't skip the egg episode. What are you doing if you're skipping the egg episode?
That's like, oh my God. Like,
absolutely.
You could write a whole 100,000 word thesis about just the egg episode and what's going on in that one, which probably is a sentence that sounds bonkers to anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about already, but that's the kind of show that this is. That's like, it's like the layers of metaphor, the social critique, the critique of shoujo tropes, the deep allegories about gender and sexuality, and also she lays an egg and it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Fuck.
It's Utena in a nutshell, or an eggshell, I guess.
Yeah. If you like Neon Genesis, you probably will like Utena. I think they're kind of in the same conversation in terms of potential subversion and surrealist. So,
you know, it's kind of like Utena is to shoujo and fairy tales what Evangelion's kind of doing for like shonen and mecha. Like,
absolutely.
Those are the two genders, actually, Utena and Evangelion.
No, it's, I mean, there's so much.
Sam, you would love Utena. Like, I was shocked when we did this episode and you didn't want to do Utena, because I was like, you would love it. There's so much. Much research. People have written so much on this show in particular.
I am desperate to watch. It's also really hard to find.
It's almost impossible to find in Australia right now. I can't. Mm-hmm. I couldn't rewatch it for this episode. Luckily, it's seared into my brain, which is good.
So what shows at the moment, or at least more, I mean, which Mercury, of course, Gundam, very, very recent. But what are the shows at the moment that you're watching that have decent representation, or something that's interesting that you've, even in the last couple of years, something that we haven't talked about yet that you'd like to recommend?
It depends on what you're into. And that's the exciting thing as well, that there is such a variety that, like, depending on what kind of calls to you, like, if you want a very, like, interesting but messy, emotional, like, teen coming-of-age story, I would recommend Bloom Into You. Gets into some very, like, teenagers having coming-of-age stories and deep, messy emotions, which may not be for everybody, but it is juicy if you like that kind of thing. On the kind of a different end of the spectrum, I will also recommend Other Side Picnic. I don't know if it's a good series, but goddamn, it's a fun series. It's like a very schlocky, like, B-horror movie kind of vibe, which is on one hand a shame because, like, it's in a funny spot because it's adapted from novels, which, like, when, you know, just prose is describing something to you, it can, like, evoke a vibe and an atmosphere in a way that, like, visuals often, you know, you lose something if you adapt into visuals. So things that were genuinely quite terrifying in the books end up just a little silly in the show with, you know, the kind of funky CGI, but still, it's a wild time. Yeah, it's about, like, two college students. They find this schism in reality that lets them go to a place called the Other Side. And it's kind of a place where, like, creatures and entities from, like, net lore, like sort of ghost stories and cryptids and stuff, they are real and they are out there. And of course, it's kind of a question. It's like, well, were these real and that's where the stories come from? Or have the stories kind of made them real through our belief in them? That's also published as a Yuri series, which means, like, it is going to have that sort of lesbian romance. They don't get together by the end of the anime, which is unfortunate, but they are going to at some point. So, like, you know, the genre prevails. I can recommend it based on that, which, I mean, you know, it is obviously a bit of a pitfall of the fact that a lot of anime is based on, like, pre-existing long-running works. So you'd be like, listen, I promise it's gay, and they end up together, but they end up together in volume 9, and the anime only gets to cover to, like, volume 3. So maybe we'll get a second season. I don't know. Read the manga. You know, that is an experience that we've had multiple times. Gosh, what else? So one that's airing now, it hasn't finished yet, so I don't quite know how it's going to pan out, but it's called, what's the full title? It's Cherry Magic. Subtitle, 30 Years of Virginity Can Make You a Wizard?
I have also watched this show. Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised by it. You know when you read a title and your heart sinks? You know, you go, oh, here we go. Here we go.
When we did the
anime blinkers up, let's go. Yeah, but and I was pleasantly surprised by what is, at the moment, I'm only a couple of episodes in, I'm kind of like, it seems to be on the wholesome side of storytelling and that kind of genre, which can be like, I mean, I don't know if you had the kind of like, when I was a teenager and I was kind of discovering what would be considered like a genre of queer anime, there was a lot of things like yaoi, the things like, was it Junjo or was it Romantica, that show that is like, oh, yeah, horror, mm-hmm, a lot of issues with consent in storytelling in anime, mm-hmm, and I can't really get past that. So that was like a huge kind of factor. So it's when I kind of had my guard up with most anime in general. So this one I was like, let's see how you go, but it seems to be wholesome so far. What's your thoughts on it?
I think so, yeah. And I think like I'm less familiar with like the boys love sort of side of things. I am reading metric tons of Yuri manga at the moment though. So if you want bonus recommendations of things that maybe haven't gotten adaptations yet, but are, you know, out there in print, I can also do that.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I I have heard that, yeah, there's kind of like each kind of subgenre can come with its own sort of pile of, let's say, baggage, because, you know, in a certain era, tropes were codified for whatever reason. So, you know, the typical one with BL is like, yeah, the kind of like consent issue sort of thing. And the typical one that you see with like Yuri is that it began sort of very codified in this genre of like schoolgirls having intimate friendships. And so it's often kind of the opposite problem where it's like, these girls don't know what sex is and never will. And it's all plausible deniability if they're just gal pals kind of thing. And it's all exists within the framework of this like very old fashioned schoolgirl setting, which if you want something that riffs on that, Yuri Is My Job is an anime from last year that was really fun. I don't know how good it is as a gateway anime, because it kind of relies on a bit of knowledge of those tropes that it's sort of like parodying and picking apart. But you could also just enjoy it. The long and short of it is there's this roleplay cafe where the costume and like the situation they're roleplaying is like, they're in this idyllic all-girls boarding school and they all have these sweet, intimate, like senpai kohai relationships. And this girl who is used to like, she's basically a mini con artist. She's like, I'm cute and I'm going to use that to get my financial security and manipulate my way to getting a trophy husband. That's her plan for life. And shenanigans ensue and she ends up in this roleplay cafe. And she's like, well, I should be really good at this because I'm used to just lying through my teeth and pretending to be cute the entire time. But she's kind of thrown off by it. And also, the real kicker, someone who works there already knows her and completely sees through her. And they got to work out their complicated past. And it's like, mwah. Again, messy drama. If you're not into that, maybe steer clear. But if you like messy teens getting up to mess, it is a really fun one.
I guess there's not much airing apart from Cherry Magic this season. That, I mean, you watched literally every single episode of everything.
I did, much to my dismay. I did.
And
watch
we didn't
every...
even do that at Annie Fan. We split it up over like six people. You're really taking it with the team down here.
It was a lot. And as I'm sure you probably know, there's a lot of absolutely terrible things airing this season, but that's okay. But then some really good stuff too.
Well, something I wouldn't mind talking to you about, I guess. I mean, part of the reason we started this show, unfortunately in anime, sometimes it's just icky or really problematic or just really like, you know, you can't. So even when you tell people sometimes, like, I'm a big anime fan, they look at you like you're some kind of, you know, and you're like, oh man, like, no, that's not it. That's not what it's all about. That's a very small subsection of problematic nonsense. Don't get me wrong. There is a lot of problematic nonsense. And I guess, you know, part of the reason why Anime Feminist exists and whatnot, it is hard sometimes. And even when the worst part is when they sneak it in, you know, when you've got a perfectly normal show and you're like, fantastic. Oh, how good is this? And then all of a sudden one scene happens and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Why?
So now I have to justify that if I recommend it. Like, man.
But I mean, how do you tackle that yourself? I mean, we talk about the anime blinkers, or as Gerald, who comes on our show a few times, calls it the anime bullshit. Like,
yeah.
we've all got like a scale of which how much you can handle. And I guess sometimes it's like, if in a better show, for example, you're like, but the story's good.
Oh gosh, I think, yeah, I think everybody does have a different threshold for anime bullshit, as you put it. And recognizing that is important when making, you know, recommendations and reviewing things and such. I think it sort of depends on where it's coming from. Like if it's something like, for example, Bloom Into You, because it gets into like messy teenage emotions, the teens are sometimes doing things you're like, that is a cancelable offense. Like, you are a problematic character, TM. But it comes from a place of like sincerity, that they are like exploring these young characters dealing with grief and sexuality and trying to figure out who they are and being messy teenage girls who will hurt each other's feelings and, you know, use and abuse each other in ways that they like don't necessarily mean to because they're working through some stuff. And, you know, a show like speaking, for example, on the sort of the anime bullshit elephant in the room, which is fan service. I have a bit more of a threshold for that if it's like, for example, a character is looking at the girl they like and the girl is framed in kind of a sexy way because you're like being invited to share the character's perspective. It's like, okay, it's still kind of ick, but it has a narrative purpose that I understand. Mm. And if the show is like talking through sexuality and desire and stuff in kind of a nuanced, interesting way, then yeah, I can kind of sit with that and go through it. Speaking about recommending things, my kind of big oops in retrospect at working for Anifem is I recommended a show called Adachi and Shimamura. Is that it? Yes. And I recommended it in the end because I was like, look, the show has a lot of good things going for it, but my God, it's also full of, the camera loves these girls' thighs so much. Although a funny thing is that like I did the premiere review for it as well, which is, you know, we divvy up all the first episodes of all the new series that are coming out by season and each staff member covers it. And I had watched the day before an absolutely rancid fan service filled thing. I don't even remember what it was, but obviously it got into my brain and I was like desensitized because I was like, Adachi and Shimamura, that's lovely. It's great. And everyone's like, why didn't you mention the copious thigh shots? And I was like, the what? And I went back and I just like hadn't noticed because my brain had been poisoned. The previous, like, were up. The worst show that I watched. I was like, by comparison, it's fine. But on its own, I was like, oh yeah, oops. So, you know, that show I ended up like, I did enjoy it, but I also had a bit less patience for things like the fan service because it was like, well, what is that actually there for?
Yes.
Like, are you exploring the desire these characters are growing for each other?
Yeah.
And like the intimacy between them? Or is it just like, we wanted to show an anime girl's shiny knees and short skirt right now? And it seemed to be more of that. So I think like, maybe for me, you know, in answer to your question, like intention and kind of like the narrative purpose of stuff plays a big part in my tolerance for various kinds of anime bullshit and whether or not it registers as anime bullshit.
Yeah, another show that a good example of a, everything had everything in place and I was like, this is going to be great. Like it was High School of the Dead and I started and I was like, zombies, cool. It's like set up as a kind of JRPG. It's like there was a mage, there was an archer, there was a swordsman. They're all like, you know, playing their own roles. And then I was just like, after the first episode, I was like, ooh, the fuck? That's some fan service.
Is that the anime where there's that shot of like someone shoots a sniper rifle and there's a slow-mo cam of the bullet going like between somebody's boobs as she dumps out of the way?
I'm fairly certain it's that one.
It's dreadful. Okay. Like, it's shocking.
I'm
like,
pretty sure.
Yeah, it's just like, it's so...
I mean, that's almost impressive. It kind of makes me want to
like,
watch
it's almost like, you're like, that's so ludicrous. Incredible. You're kind of like, wow, okay, yeah. The audacity. Yeah.
That was me with Chain.
It's the point of the audacity. You're like, yeah. I'm actually kind of impressed. Yeah.
that's so crazy. It almost works, but it's... And again, just ruined. Because a lot of the time I sit there and go, if this wasn't here, if you didn't include that, this show would be perfectly, it doesn't need it. There's no narrative purpose. This isn't helping a character grow. It's just gratuitous. And that's when my anime bullshit gets hit. And I'm like, this is pointless and frankly makes me feel super uncomfortable. I'm like, I can't recommend this show to anybody. How could I possibly do so? And then I walk away and it's, yeah, it does get frustrating. And especially those little like, even just weird moments, even like something like My Hero Academia with Mineta. Is it Mineta with the little pops off?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah,
that is,
you know, and you just
name.
And again, I'm like, why is he here? Like, it's not funny. Get him out. Like, just pointless. And that's a good example of like perfectly normal show. Perfectly like, do you like X-Men? Check this out. And then that guy comes on screen, and you're like, ah, nah, it's not always like this. Don't worry about it. He's only a small part of it, man. Don't worry about it. It's cool. I don't know. But Charlie, you obviously, I mean. For example, there was what was that show out this season, which was just horrific, Chained Soldier. Shocking.
Chained Soldier, like, again, similar, like, a part of me wanted to like it. I was like, as I said, I was like, is this going to be like maybe some kind of feminist masterpiece? Like, is it, is it like going to be subversive? You know, like if I told you some of the content in Utena without any context, you'd be like, whoa.
Yeah.
Chain Soldier, unfortunately, no, it's not a classic of our times. And I will hopefully never think about it ever again.
Yeah.
And that's good. Yeah, I think it's a really wonderful point about intention. I think that's something I've been trying to kind of express, but you did it so eloquently, so thank you. But yeah, it's intention of character. Yeah. So even things like Chainsaw Man, which I know are problematic, yeah. But if I see like it's through the point of view of Denji, I can kind of forgive that fan service, unlike something like Fire Force, where I actually cannot watch it.
It can be contextual as well. Like we have, in fact, one of the really early articles on the site that I remember really well. I believe it's by Lauren Orsini. Let me double check that to make sure that's correct. But it was about, it really stuck with me because it was about like, yeah, this question of fan service. And the article made the point, they were like, listen, if it makes sense, like if the show is a goofy harem rom-com, of course you're going to see TNA, you know, that's what it's doing. Or if it's a show like, what is it? I think Keijo is the example they use, which is like the one where the girls are in swimsuits and they're fighting each other with their butts.
Yeah.
The butt
wrestling. Yeah, that's the premise of the show. It's going to be stupid and fan service-y and, you know, you're going to see butts in swimsuits. But if it's like a show that had nothing to do with that and suddenly there's a shot of someone's tits, it's like, oh, did you just like think I would stop paying attention if you didn't show me something sexy? Like, you know, like it becomes sort of insulting when it's like unnecessarily added to stuff. Or if it's added in a way that like this female character is genuinely really strong and well written and interesting and motivated and we have to shove the camera up her skirt every chance we get. It's like, well, like why? You know, like what does that add to the story? You've obviously just like added that in, like the story would be the same if you had framed it differently. And that I think is another really good point.
Thank you so much for all of your recommendations and your insights and everything. Like, honestly, I've had such a wonderful conversation and I do really want to hear your list of Yuri manga, actually, if that's okay.
I can do that. Oh my God. Okay. So rattling them off, lightning round. She Loves to Cook and She Loves to Eat is a like foodie rom-com about two neighbors. Then they cook together and they slowly fall in love. And it's really interesting too, because it's like, you know, it's a cute, fluffy rom-com, but it also, they have some really interesting conversations in there about like the state of like queer representation in Japanese media and like, you know, what it feels like to realize that you're a lesbian in a world where everyone kind of like expects you to get married to a man and like make lunch for him. And she's like, well, I think I just want to cook for me. And also, do I like women? Oh, shit. So, you know, it's got some of that really interesting, like, really contemporary, like, social commentary and stuff, as well as some really delicious-looking food. Okay, Catch These Hands is also a great short manga, which I recommend for the title alone. Excellent localization. It's about a woman in her early 20s who used to be a delinquent when she was in high school, and she's like, I'm going to set myself on the straight and narrow, I'm going to be normal, I'm going to be respectable. And then she runs into her old rival, and they're like, do you want to have a fist fight for old time's sake? And in fact, if you lose, you have to go on a date with me. And she's like, fuck yeah, let's brawl. And then they end up in this like weird little relationship and end up falling in love. Oh my gosh, I will mention as well as another anime, which I would recommend you watch this if you want, you know, a fantasy Yuri, but also if you're sick of boilerplate isekai protagonists. It's The Executioner and Her Way of Life. Do you guys, this was a couple of years ago. Did you follow this one?
No, didn't watch it.
So it starts off with, don't remember his name, the Japanese equivalent of Joe Bloggs, gets summoned into a fantasy world. He gets sort of taken under the wing of this priestess who's like, hello, you are an isekai protagonist. You've been brought to this world from a different one. You've been given special powers. And actually my job is to assassinate you, because we've had so many goddamn isekai protagonists come into our world and make a mess of things that now we have a religious order dedicated to killing them and getting them out of the way. And that is the first episode. And it's so good. It evolved something more complex than that, because then, you know, a new one comes in, she gets a new target, but she can't kill her, something to do with her protagonist powers. And, you know, so like they have this tension where she's like, well, I have been assigned to literally murder you. you are the target and I'm an assassin, but we got to kind of work out a way to coexist while I figure out a way to do that because you can't be killed. And it goes from there. It's like a great little like kind of dark fantasy adventure romp. That, yeah, again, if you're sick of isekai with the same protagonist every time, that first episode may be very cathartic just on its own.
Well, amazing. Thank you so much again for joining us. So where can people, obviously an anime feminist, but where else can people find any of your work? You mentioned it at the top of the show, but if you want to give another plug.
Sure. So yeah, so my blog you mentioned, the one that I've been running for a long time, that's theaficionado.wordpress.com. You can find my like more general writing about like books, manga, other things I'm interested in. And of course, you know, I link from there to all of my content on Anifem and Anime Herald and everywhere else, which yeah, check out those sites as well. They're great resources and great places to find like, you know, cool niche content about anime you love or maybe have never heard of. I will say as well, our submissions box is open at Anifem at the moment. So if you have an idea for an article, you want to take something apart, you want to talk about why you love something kind of from this sort of intersectional lens, chuck us a pitch, you can get in. You know, you don't have to be a super experienced writer. You certainly don't have to have written a thesis on the egg episode of Utena. you have an idea, throw
put
it
that
on
in the bin.
We'd love to hear from people.
So, well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. It really was absolutely fantastic conversation. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and such an incredible list of shows for everyone to check out. And thank you all for watching. As always, as I mentioned at the top, you can find us on our social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, and or YouTube. You can find out what we're up to on gatewaytoanime.com. If you really like what we're doing, you can find us on Patreon. So thank you all so much. Alex, again, amazing. Thank you for spending the time to chat to us. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
It's been so much fun.
Thank you.
So thanks, Willa. See you all next time.